So, Kevin, you got to start this one.
Okay. Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Kevin, who's that guy over there with his back against the record machine?
You mean the one with the hot shoe burning down the avenue?
Yeah. Wait, here he comes.
Hi, I'm Top Jimmy. I'm the king. All right, we made it to the end of the week. It's Friday.
Yeah, we made it to Friday.
Reaching down, grabbing the album of the day.
Final.
It is Van Halen 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this week we've been talking about classic Van Halen because it's the 40th anniversary of the debut album.
Uh-huh.
Talking about different records each day, and now we're at really what some might say would be the last
true Van Halen. True Van Halen.
Van Halen album, I don't know. Depending on where you fall on that. But we don't need to go into that. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. 1984 out in January 1984.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it well. This was a big, big album.
It was
big,
huge.
Big. It was massive, man. Yeah.
It was the number two album of the year behind Thriller.
And Thriller, I don't know how many copies that sold. A few, but...
Yeah, it did all right.
1984 did pretty good, yeah.
Eddie Van Halen actually... Was on Thriller as well. That's right.
Yeah, he was. He had a pretty good year. Yeah,
he did.
Pretty decent year.
I'd say so.
And the only album I'm aware of in rock and roll history with an angel smoking on the front.
Wasn't there a Black Sabbath album?
Oh, maybe there was. Could be.
I don't
wrong.
Know. They probably had angels doing something that they shouldn't have been doing.
Else. Yeah.
All right. This is Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linhan.
I'm Patrick Faust.
I'm Kevin Spain.
Kevin Spain is with us all week because he's a big Van Halen fan. And let's talk about that for a second here, right? You talked earlier about how you got into the band back in this era, but you recently saw Van Halen live, right? You did not see them live back in the day?
I didn't see them live with Dave back when they were huge. You know, for the most part, I was a little bit too young to go. Unlike your friend, I didn't get to go to concerts when I was 14. So I didn't get to go back then. And then by the time I was able to go, I just missed them. I lived in Tennessee at the time, and I missed them in Memphis and in Nashville during those tours. And it was one of those things I regretted forever. You know, they break up right after this album.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, that's it. I'm never going to see them. I actually did see them with Sammy Hagar. They were the headlining band in the Monsters of Rock tour.
I saw the same thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which was about, what, 87?
Something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah, coming on to the end of the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. And now, if you talk about heavy metal, that was a hard-driving show
with
the Scorpions
and
Metallica and these guys.
Yeah.
And then I saw David Lee Roth at Club La Vila in Panama City.
Wow.
Like 1995,
seems
I believe.
Like a good place to see him.
It really was a great show. He had a guitarist, and I do not know his name. All I know was he was a really big guy, really big, probably weighed about 300 pounds.
Oh, really? Wow.
Could play. He was so good.
Which Panama City are we talking about here?
Florida.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Panama City, Florida.
Not Panama.
I didn't know. Not the actual Panama. Panama City, Florida.
Yeah. All right.
Which would have been a good place to see him, obviously, especially if he could play Panama.
Right? Only one song got close with it, that show.
And then I saw him on this last tour that they were on here in Nissan? What is it? The amphitheater. Whatever it is now.
Jiffy Lube.
Jiffy Lube. And it was the funny thing about it is they basically played the songs that we've talked about all week.
Is that right?
That was what they played. They didn't play really anything.
Greatest hits.
You know, later than like the first three albums, I think. Maybe some of the songs off this one. And Dave really can't sing anymore. He's pretty much lost his voice. But the best thing about that show is it didn't matter because everybody in the crowd sang all the songs for him
anyway.
Carried
the weight, yeah.
So we all sang the songs and Eddie played and it was a great show. So.
Is that a weird thing for a band though? And you think of all the bands in history, Van Halen is kind of unique in this sense that they've had success with two different lead singers. There have been a few others, you know, AC/DC is one, and there have been a few others. But
Black Sabbath, which we talked about a minute ago, was one
that's
of
right.
The
that's right. That's actually probably the closest.
Yeah, that's right.
Comparison, because at least even with the AC/DC, they didn't really even just stop to consider the fact they just brought in another guy, and right. he just kind of carried on, and they massively successful. Yeah. But they didn't reject the earlier era the way Van Halen has, like, two distinct periods.
It's like
right?
two totally different
it's
bands.
It's like two different bands.
No doubt.
Because when they brought Sammy on, I think at least initially live, he might do a couple of their earlier songs, but I don't think he ever really embraced it. He's sort of like, if something had to do, and then they could just phase that out and just be this new band essentially. And then later, when whatever happened, Sammy's gone and they bring back Dave, they just ignore that whole second half of their career and just go back to the first.
None of those songs in this last tour.
It's really kind of a weird thing in rock history.
Yeah, and it's also weird that kind of the one era came to an end on one of their most massively successful albums. Usually you could see a band like getting bitter and kind of falling off the radar, but this was like they were as big as they've ever been.
Yeah. I think they probably hit their peak musically as this first group.
Yeah.
With this album. And we talked about this, I guess, a couple of days ago, that it's some of the problems that they had started around 1980, 81 maybe. And I think this album, 1984, is really when Eddie won. I think Dave won
on
Diver Down, and Eddie won. Eddie built his studio and all of that, and basically won. And they were very good, but they also started the change, I think, with the synthesizers being pretty dominant in a few of these songs was completely different for them.
So Eddie basically made a preemptive strike on this album and said the way that he's going to assert control over the record was to build his own studio and basically start working on the album before Dave Ted Templeman could even get involved. Yeah. Right. So, but anyway, I want to go back to one thing you were saying about the success of the band though, because first of all, when I put out some stuff on social media that we were going to do these Van Halen episodes, and I said, tell us your favorite song from the classic David Lee Roth era of the band, there were more than one person who said, there is no other era. Like that's mm-hmm. you know, blasphemous to even suggest that there is a Van Halen that wasn't this era with David Lee Roth. So there are very strong opinions on that. But even though this album, 1984, ended up selling more than 10 million, like their debut album, I mean, that's to have two diamond certified albums, right? It's kind of amazing. But it's not like the Van Hagar albums didn't sell.
No.
I mean,
they were very successful.
They still were like multi-platinum releases.
They were. It was a whole different audience, though, I think. I think they got a whole different group of fans with the Sammy.
Yeah.
Because they were more, you know, we talked about they were a pop rock.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways with some of their songs. I think that was really, in a lot of ways, the focus, even though I think Eddie was driving with, you know, we're going to write these deeper songs and musically we're going to be different. But a lot of those songs were really geared to being hits with Sammy. And so I think it was a different group. And I think Sammy had a lot of fans too. I mean, Sammy had been a rocker for a long time, and there were a lot of people. Yeah. And I actually saw him as a solo act warm up for ZZ Top in the early 80s.
That's pretty
cool. He was fantastic.
Well, it's like Van Hagar said, only time will tell if we stand the test of time.
Excellent. Nice job, Patrick.
All right. Well, this album, 1984, I think has stood the test of time. I think I was just listening to it again today. And as I mentioned yesterday, it's really is like, you know, hearing from an old friend. Mm-hmm. And I love that about it. It takes me back to a certain time.
Were you instantly kind of transported back to those moments?
Yes, I love it. So, massive hit album. Is there a favorite song for you, Kevin?
Well, my favorite song was probably one that was not one of the hits at all. In fact, I don't even think it was released as a single. My favorite song is Drop Dead Legs.
Oh, okay.
And I love the driving guitar and the way that song goes. I listened to the synthesizer songs, but they weren't my favorite. They're good songs, but they weren't my favorite. Of the hits, I loved Hot for Teacher because I absolutely love the drum intro and the way Eddie plays the guitar in that song. The intro to that is great. And Ed, we were talking about this earlier when with, I think it was on Women and Children First, they do a couple of those intros like that, and it sort of sets it up for down the road. And I think Alex sort of asserts himself a lot in this album, his drum playing.
Well, I'm curious to hear this again now, see what you like about it, or hear you talk about it, because we haven't done a lot of like deep cut kind of stuff this week. So let's hear Drop Dead Legs. There's a certain swagger in that song,
there
I would
is.
Say. Yes.
And there's some crazy lyrics. I mean, there's the dig that steam, giant butt, throw my rope, loop-de-loop, nice teeth, Betty Boop. But I love the transitions that Eddie does with that and the drum playing. And there's a great, it has a great closeout instrumental from Eddie. And we talked about this earlier in the week. There's not a lot of songs where there's a long, you know, guitar solo, and that song ends with like a 2-minute solo, and that's what's really good about it.
And you know, I think this record had a brighter, more modern kind of a overall sound.
It was,
and I think that's because of the studio, right? And not, you know, recording in kind of the same place there in L.A. and Eddie, you know, asserting himself, as you guys said, but you can really hear it on that song too, just this bigger and brighter and wider and more modern, you know, sounding than the earlier stuff.
But even though this song sounds more like their older stuff because it's that driving guitar, but you're right, it's sort of updated into the 80s sound.
It did. Updated, yeah.
It did. Mm-hmm. And the synthesizers were a big part of that. And
without a doubt.
It takes on, you know, maybe even some new wavy kind of elements because of that. Although one of the things I'm really impressed about with a song like Jump, which again, that's another candidate for a perfect pop song.
Sure.
But, well, two things I want to say about Jump is, one is that, as a kid in high school who, had to take piano lessons all those years and do all of that, that I of course learned how to play that on piano. Right. And would impress my friends that I can play Jump.
Watch this.
Yes. But the other thing too is, that Eddie not only has the keyboard riff that apparently, he had in his back pocket for a couple of years at least, but it took a while to convince the rest of the band to go in that direction. And the feeling was it just wouldn't work as a guitar riff. It had to be a keyboard. But anyway, but listen sometime to that keyboard solo in Jump. Because it's really impressive in that he's doing kind of the same things that he might do on guitar, that, you know, this kind of crazy like arpeggios and stuff and it really could go really badly. It could really be a very proggy kind of thing, but there's a certain lightness to the way he plays, and there's a certain kind of playfulness even in that it just manages to like thread that needle and just work really well.
And it exploded out of the radio when you heard that opening riff. It was just like, boom. Might as well
jump. Well, that was their first number one hit. And you know, what you said is exactly right. You could almost see him playing that on a guitar in some ways. Yeah. That, you know, that diddle, 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 you know, where he could just drive that. In.
It was almost like he wanted to show off, like, I can do this too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had some nice air guitar there from Kevin Spain.
Yeah.
It was well done.
Sorry.
We'll get video going next time. We've got our GoPro.
But there is a feeling on 1984 that, again, maybe going back to the Eddie, where he wanted to take the band, was that this feels like a real album. You know, that this is not just a collection of songs, but there's a real feeling here. And before we, I'll play one cut, but I want to address the Hot for Teacher thing for just a minute, which is, you know, it's such a catchy song that you can't help but really like it. And I love the drum intro and then the way the guitar comes in and everything about it's great. Do I wish the lyrical content were a little bit different? Yes.
Sure.
So unlike Jamie's Crying, you're saying. Yes,
but it's hard not to like that song. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah. In the same way Katy Perry slightly regrets, I Kissed a Girl.
And then you also have to talk about the fact that at this point in the MTV era, they were also huge because of that. So
the videos, the video really sold the song.
Yes.
The video is the reason this song got so big.
I think I've seen it.
Here's a band, you know, that came along in 78, really, you know, pre-MTV.
Yeah.
But could not be better suited for MTV, right?
Yeah, that's why I was saying way back in the beginning of the week, some of the stuff they did, even though it was in the late 70s, kind of felt already like the decade was here.
Like they figured it out before everybody else. They had the colorful clothes and the kind of like big smiles and the big gestures.
Yeah.
They were very theatrical kind of band.
Certainly were.
To the point even where the Hot for Teacher video, you know, is it something I want to sit down and with my 17-year-old daughter and say, look at this, dear.
Like, I love this music.
Like, no, but if you just took out certain clips of it, the parts where they're like dancing in those like suits that's hilarious,
it
isn't
is very
it?
Funny.
And it's kind of like, it's choreographed, but it's like sort of,
they're a little off
and not quite in sync. That's hilarious. That's really funny. I like that they sort of have like these like teenage versions of themselves right in the video. That's really funny too. And then for my money, the part where Eddie, the guitar solo in the song where he's like walking down that like long table, is it like in a library or a cafeteria or something like that, playing the guitar?
Yeah, that's
it's
funny.
The big sort of trail, what are they called, tracking shot?
Yeah,
it's great, you know. So they embraced the videos and they did some really good things with them. You know, it was a different time, let's just say that. Okay.
It certainly was.
All right. The song I want to play is also kind of a deep cut here, but I think it sort of brings a lot of elements of what they had done before and really kind of crystallizes it and makes it something. It's almost like kind of like this is the best version of all those things we were trying before. So let's hear this. Top Jimmy. I don't just like it because of the title, but
yeah.
But no, but
that
I think
song was about you back then, man.
That's right, absolutely. But I think, you know, we talk again about sort of like the old timiness thing that they have sometimes, but this is like, it's like baked into the rock song. Mm-hmm. It's not even like, it's almost like they just figured it out finally. Like, we can just put it
in
our own
kind of thing.
We need
to make it something separate.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the song does really have a certain swing.
Yeah.
Oh,
to it,
without
you know?
A doubt. Yeah, absolutely.
It's it's basically to honor a group that they liked. It was a band. I think it's, I don't know where they were from. I'm assuming they're an LA band called Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Picks.
Yep.
And so that was sort of a salute to them. And, you know, Yeah, it's a good song. It's a really good song. Mm-hmm. It's another one, though, I think kind of like Drop Dead Legs and even House of Pain that are not the synthesized. It's not that different sound from the other songs in this album,
yeah.
Even though it is. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
Yeah, it does. It totally makes sense.
Have I drank too many beers?
It feels like sort of an advancement of the sound they were doing before, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Which all the more makes it odd that that was the end of the era, right? They had their first number one single. They had actually made some musical leaps forward, and suddenly, you know, it would be very fascinating to see what the album after 1984 would have been had Dave, you know, stayed with the band.
Not gotten so full of himself that he had to go solo, right?
He did. Yes. California girls were coming.
Oh, that stuff. Yeah.
Well, I think he was also, I think he was also upset over this direction. I don't necessarily think this is where he wanted to go with Jump and I'll Wait and those kinds of things. And I think he felt like that was really that Eddie was pushing to do more and more of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's not what he wanted to do. But you're right. He did want to be a solo guy. But I think if they could have, if they just hadn't got to the point where they couldn't stand each other, which happens in rock bands all the time, it would have been great to see, you know, maybe he could have done the solo album and then they could have still stayed together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eddie said actually, because David did the solo EP, the one that had California Girls and Just a Gigolo, I think right around the time of this. It was before they broke up.
Yeah. I think it might have been right after the tour, right on the tour or something.
Like that. Yeah. And Eddie actually liked it because it kept Dave occupied and sort of away from him. And so he could work on this stuff on his own without all that interference. Yeah. So he wouldn't have minded maybe if they had sort of parallel.
Yeah, you know, go band have your solo career.
But I think Dave probably, like a lot of, you know, frontmen, and as you said, he was sort of born to be a frontman, you know, had a lot of people saying, you know, Dave, you're the real star of the band.
I'm sure he
did. If you don't like the way this is going, break away, do your own thing, take all the money, right?
And I'll get 15% of it.
And, you know, it's a funny thing because I think he had moderate success as a solo artist. Maybe his first couple of solo albums did okay, but then he just, you know, he couldn't sustain it. He wasn't that kind of an artist. And as we mentioned, Van Halen, the band, went on maybe not the same kind of success, but certainly plenty. Yeah. Okay. Oh, and one other thing I wanted to mention, we were talking about recording and this being in Eddie's home studio that he had built. The other funny thing about Van Halen, before this, they were all recorded at Sunset Sounds, I think it was. Mm-hmm. This was never a band that felt like they needed to go away, record an album somewhere. No. Let's go up to like Bearsville.
Yeah. You know? Like a country cottage in Ireland or something.
Yeah, some castle in England somewhere. They never felt the need to do that. Mm. They just, you know, basically we're going to book 3 weeks at a studio in LA and we're going to record another Van Halen album. Right. And
five cases of whiskey sent in. Right. Be all right.
But with that, I think you always had this sense of like, they were, I never look at that in a bad way. I always had the sense of like, they were a professional rock band. Like they were putting out rock music,
yes, they were.
You know? And it was, and where better to do that than in LA? Just get in the studio and play these songs and be what we, you know, basically want you to be. Right?
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Don't make it too complicated.
Yeah. All right. Any last thoughts, Kevin? You've been here all week. You got anything else you got to get off your chest?
You know, I've had a great time here all week.
Thank you so much, man.
It's a nice basement you've got here.
It really is.
Thank
you. Come over anytime. Cool. You want to shoot pool or play shuffleboard or play the jukebox, whatever.
Just not while we're recording, if you could keep it down.
I think your family doesn't want to see me for a while, so maybe a while before I come back.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll be back next week with more Rock in the Suburbs. It's not about Van Halen. We're going to talk about other things, I think. But Kevin, you'll come back sometime, right?
I hope so.
Me too.
Talk about something else.
Anytime you want to talk about an old band related, it's probably it's probably more my speed.
All right, that's fine. That's
bring it back for the Motley Hatchet week that I have in mind.
I had that on 8-track.
Oh, me too.
All right, please listen to Rock in the Suburbs
every day.
All the big podcast platforms. Tell us what you think about Van Halen.
Yep.
You can call, and here's where the number really starts to make sense. It's 44. Wait, I've screwed it up.
To someone, anyway.
The number is
612-440-1984.
There you go. Or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram @suburbspod. And Kevin, you want to plug anything? Anything you got going on?
Well, you know, since you know, I'm not on it, or I haven't been on it in a long time, but the podcast that I've worked on for, at least 3 years now.
Yeah, you were a pioneer.
Yeah, NBA right. A to Z. Mm-hmm. It's a USA Today podcast where we talk NBA, and Sam Amick and Jeff Silgett, they're NBA reporters there at USA Today. They have a lot of great interviews. In fact, Paul George of the Thunder was on the last podcast we did. We've had just about everybody from the league on there at one time
it's
or another.
It's a big time show, folks.
It's good stuff. And they break down the trade deadline in the last show that we did. And we'll start looking ahead to All-Star and playoffs and all of that coming up. So, we were really looking forward to, you know, that show continuing to grow. And it's good. So if any music listeners here also like basketball.
Yes.
There it is.
I'm one.
Two right. solid weeks on the Cavaliers trades coming up soon.
We could do several episodes on the Cavaliers. Yeah. They've been a lot of drama in Cleveland.
So last night, as we record this, I sit down, got in last night, and I sit down to watch my favorite NBA team. So my team from my youth is not the Wizards.
Right.
I didn't grow up around here. That's my team I've adopted since. Right. But my favorite team from my youth is the Pistons.
Okay.
So I'm excited because they made deal to get Blake Griffin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they've been winning since they got him all these games. And so last night they're on ESPN and I sit down. It's the start of the fourth quarter. They're playing the Clippers. It's like tied when I sit down. And from that moment on, they just, pooped the bed.
Yeah. You totally jinxed them, huh?
I totally did. My first chance to see them with the new, you know, star that they trade for.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, they were just terrible. So,
were you wearing your Cleveland Browns gear of any sort at that point?
Man, so.
Figured you'd be a Pacers fan, being an Indiana man.
Well, I went to school in Indiana, but I'm originally from Northwest Ohio, very close to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of split my allegiances between Detroit teams and Cleveland teams. So Tigers, Pistons on the Detroit side and Browns on the Cleveland side.
Right.
Ooh.
I know.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, we got to talk to you about those teams over there.
Yeah. Well, I've had success on the one side
in
my time, but not the other one. But you can't, you know, once you pick.
That's true.
You can't change, right? And here's the thing about the Browns.
You can't change.
Here's the thing about the Browns. It's all upside
on out. They can't go anywhere but up, you would think.
All right, let's get out of this thing. I think we did this already, but I'm Jim Lenahan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm Kevin Spain.
And we'll talk to you guys again next week. And if you had to pick one hit song, one hit single off of 1984, what would it be?
I think you should pick, Jim. This was your album. This was your favorite album. I think you should pick the one.
Well, we already talked about Jump. So let's talk about this other one. Here's just a funny little ironic sort of tidbit. If anybody remembers, when would this have been? Like the late 80s or so, when they were trying to drive Manuel Noriega out of Panama, right? And he was like holed up in like a church or something, and they couldn't get him. And so one of the methods that the military used to try to get him out was to play like hard rock
all
like
night
blasting
long.
Yeah. Like all night long to try to get him. And ironically, one of the bands that they played was Van Halen. It might have been a song like this. So we'll talk to you later. We'll be right back.
This is proof you got to stick with your team because I got a new wallet for Christmas.
Oh, a Bucks wallet.
Buccaneers Velcro wallet. Very nice.